Yes, that's fine, Your Honor. Any order is fine with me. So I'll start then.
How much time would you like to
Typically, I ask for 3 minutes. So I don't have any lights in front of me, but I do have my watch, and I will make it so that it is on an even time. So I'll just start 12 minutes, and then I'll when I hit the 12 minutes, would the court kindly just alert me to that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. And may it please the court, again, I'm Andrew Sachs, counsel to the appellant, Kareem Turner. As with the other appeals, with the exception of the Macias matter, I was not trial counsel, but I am certainly familiar with the record and have proceeded as appellate counsel. Mr. Turner, of course, a writ was granted, an appeal. Mr. Turner was convicted in the Norfolk Circuit Court after a jury trial. The Honorable Joseph A. Migliosi, Jr. presiding. He was found guilty of first-degree murder, attempted robbery, two counts of use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, for a total, of 42 years, active years, in the Virginia State Penitentiary. The sole assignment of error is that the trial court erred in overruling the defendant's motions to strike the first-degree murder and associated use of a firearm indictments at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's evidence and at the conclusion of all of the evidence, and further erred in overruling the demotions to set aside the verdicts of guilty on the grounds that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to support the indictments and convictions. And the essential ground is that there is insufficient evidence to identify him as the criminal agent, but for inherently incredible testimony as a matter of law that should not be worthy of belief, even though it may facially state things that could arguably perhaps give rise to some inferences. So with respect to that assignment, let me go.
Yes, Mr. Sack, my understanding of the assignment is it's simply an argument regarding whether the evidence established that Mr. Turner is the criminal agent, you can see every other element is met.
Yes, that's correct. That's the argument. That the evidence was insufficient to establish that he killed the victim. Yes, that is correct. That's exactly right. First of all, as the court knows, and I cited this, I mean it's axiomatic, but in any sense we cited a few things, but it's hornbook that and a critical element of first degree murder is that the defendant is the criminal agent, either killed the victim or was a principal in the second degree. My reading of the record does not reflect that the Commonwealth seriously espoused the latter, that they took the position that he was, in fact, an active principal in the first degree contributing to the death of the victim. There is eyewitness testimony from a witness, Ricola Lachey, that the defendant was at a party in the vicinity of the scene of the shooting and that she later saw the defendant in the vicinity outside the party around the time the victim was shot, but neither Ms. Lachey nor any other witness ever testified that the defendant, in fact, fired a weapon or much less shot the victim. Ms. Lachey pointed out...
Mr. Sachs, let me ask you a question about that.
On
page 10 of your brief, in summarizing the facts, you note that a witness, Sir Thomas Boyd, testified that he saw the defendant and Roy Turner shooting at the scene.
Well,
and then he saw someone on the ground.
That is true. He did. As I comment on that is true. He did say that. There was that one strand of testimony that he did shoot. So I do concede that. But with that amendment, there's no evidence that he shot the victim, and other than we'll get to the inherently incredible part. And the only evidence that he fired a weapon was that he fired, but that alone would not be sufficient. I mean, firing a weapon doesn't establish that he killed the victim, much less hit him or did anything, frankly, even aiding and abetting necessarily. But again, the Commonwealth's theory being that he was an active principal in the first degree. But there is a dearth of direct testimony, that he killed the victim. And the one witness, Ms. Lachey, did say that she saw at one point that she believed what was a gun in the victim's hand. She then later testified in the same during the same basic examination that you wasn't sure whether he had a gun. And I cited Moore against Commonwealth, which is a case I'm familiar with because it's one of the few that I have prevailed in the Supreme Court in a criminal matter, 1997 case, where the Commonwealth's evidence on an essential element is, quote, in a state of equipoise, end quote. That's not sufficient to carry the burden. And here, analogously, she says she saw him with a gun at one point, which she believed to be a gun, and later she says she wasn't sure. I think that's at best equipoise, and you really can't use that to support the conviction. So basically, without an eyewitness stating that he fired a gun, and with only one saying that he did some shooting, then I would urge the court that that alone wouldn't be enough, just alone, to establish murder or that he killed the victim, which leaves the only remaining evidence are the purported jailhouse statements that the defendant either made or came through witnesses whose uncorroborated testimony is all either incredible as a matter of law or is at best ambiguous or insufficient. I believe, Your Honors, that at some point this court, or one of our appellate courts, has to state, and in fact they have stated, and I'll mention in a minute, particularly in the sexual assault area, but at some point there's got to be a limit to how many felonies, how much incredible testimony, how much impeachable testimony can pass muster in any case. If it's open field, if it's open season, if you can lay a witness up there with 100 convictions, felony convictions, and as long as they mouth the words, and it's always a jury question, then I think that is again a result that the law does not intend. At some point, there has to be a limit to what can be credible as a matter of law. We know, for example, in Willis v. Commonwealth, which is in the rape or sexual assault contest, and I cited this in my brief, that the Supreme Court has said, we have repeatedly said that it is not sufficient to warrant a verdict of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt if the evidence is inherently incredible or so contrary to human experience or to usual human behavior to render it unworthy of belief. Barker against Commonwealth also supports that. Barker's a 1956 case. Willis is a 1977 case. They both seem to be good law. So we know from the Supreme Court, particularly in the area of sexual assault, but not necessarily limited, there is a limit to even where facially, where testimony facially says what needs to be said, it still doesn't have to be accepted. And in this case, if you examine the three witnesses whose testimony is essential for the first element of killing, we just simply feel that this is the case, the paradigm case, where the limit has been met. For example, Terrell Crawley testified to certain admissions by the defendant while Mr. Crawley and the defendant were in jail. Before you look at the content of the admissions, which themselves are problematic, you look at what are his credibility markers. At 33, he's been convicted of 26 prior felony convictions, including two misdemeanors involving identity theft. His record includes 4 grand larcenies, a conspiracy to commit a felony, 2 stolen goods felonies, possession of a firearm by a felon, possession of stolen property, credit card theft, possession of burglarious tools, uttering, possession of narcotics, forgery felonies, false pretenses, armed burglary, 2 attempted robberies, 2 uses of a firearm in the commission of a felony. As gatekeepers, some juries will believe almost anything, even if you can say it is technically a credibility question. They might believe anything. The gatekeepers, which are Your Honors, have to draw some limit to this, or it simply will, there'll never be any kind of limit. It would be limitless. It would be infinite. And if this doesn't reach the limit, I would submit, as a matter of law, credibility, nothing does. Mr. Crawley also was serving an 18-year sentence. His attorney admitted he was going to ask for a reduction based on Mr. Crawley's testimony. On the other hand, later, Mr. Crawley himself contradicted that and said that his anticipated motion for reconsideration was related only to his testimony in the instant case, claiming that the motion for reconsideration has nothing to do with this situation. Well, excuse me, it was not related to his testimony in the instant case. So his own lawyer, at first he said, that the lawyer said he was asking for a reduction. He was hoping for that. And then Mr. Crawley himself says, no, I'm not asking for anything. That makes no sense. I mean, that's just inherently incredible that the man would say that he's not looking for some benefit when he's got an 18-year sentence and his own attorney says, through him, that he's looking for a reduction. So given that inherently incredible, what I believe, record, 26 felonies of every stripe and color, and his directly contradictory statements under oath about his very motive to testify, we believe it is facially, even though credible, that it is incredible as a matter of law. Even if you could accept that it's credible as a matter of law, not inherently credible or unworthy of belief as a matter of law, his statements are at best ambiguous. He claims he told that the defendant told him he's been at a party and that during a dice game, the victim was winning and the defendant was losing. The defendant said he waited for the victim to come out. When the victim walked off, the defendant called him. The defendant said that the victim turned around and said that the defendant started, quote, drilling him. What does drilling him mean? Nobody offered an explanation. There was no expert. Maybe you could argue, well, that's within the common realm of a juror. I'm not sure it is. What does drilling mean? The defendant's statement that he started, quote, drilling the victim, we urge, is so ambiguous and unclear as to amount to speculation that at best somehow equates to that would not equate to an admission that he shot the victim. In other words, without an eyewitness and somebody only saying he shot and without any explanation of drilling, it is a very dicey proposition to convict a man of murder and end up with 42 years for all of the offenses. Witness Thomas Kane testified that he had a conversation in jail with the defendant, and all he said was that the defendant was someone who, quote, looks like the defendant. Looks like the defendant isn't enough as a matter of law. It may be, it's possible, maybe it's probable, but as a foundational matter, that alone, that couldn't establish that the defendant made the statement. Looked like just isn't enough. Fitzhugh Warren, the third one, testified to conversations he had with the defendant while in custody, in which the defendant said, quote, I just pumped 19 hot into a MF-er, and, quote, we got that New York MF-er. Now, Mr. Warren, just like the first witness I mentioned, Mr. Crawley, he has 15 prior felony convictions. He's 46. Yes. Is that my 12 minutes?
You're about 15 seconds into your rebuttal time.
Okay, I'm going to keep going, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
And I'll just eat up what I've got, or go until I can, don't feel I need to go anymore. 10 prior felonies of those 15 involved lying, cheating, or stealing. He had 4 misdemeanors involving moral turpitude. His record included, but was not limited to, felony identity theft, drug possession, credit card larceny, credit card fraud, third offense petty larceny, eluding the police, habitual offender, grand larceny, burglary, attempted grand larceny, assault on a police officer, and a third offense DUI. And he admitted he was pending sentencing at the time of his testimony against the defendant. So he suffers from the same infirmities, I urge, as the first witness. There is a limit to credibility, to what's credible as a matter of law. We cannot let juries just speculate on anybody. We as trained legal professionals know at some point there is just too much. All of these terrible falsehoods, deceits, you know, predatory behavior on society, thefts, lies, it just at some point it's inherently incredible and it's unfair to convict somebody on that kind of testimony of first-degree murder. And lastly, Mr. Sir Thomas Boyd.
Yes, Mr. Well, you're about to talk about Mr. Thomas Boyd, but I guess my question is, even if we were to accept that there is, with the jailhouse confessions and extensive records, maybe there's a point at which it should almost seem inherently incredible, does it matter that there were other witnesses who testified regarding the party testified regarding the other things, like Sir Thomas Boyd testified that he was there with a gun. Other people said they thought they saw him with a gun. There was no question there was a party. It appears there's no question there was a dice game. So there are corroborative elements corroborating the statements of the jailhouse confessors.
Well, they don't really. I respect his honor's inquiry, and it's a good one, but just being at a party with a gun, I mean, there are a lot of, for better or worse in our day and age, a lot of people have guns, and that's we've got a Second Amendment right to have one. So it may partially corroborate that he was there with a weapon that was capable of killing someone, but in the core element of the case, the core testimony, it isn't corroborated. And it comes down to the word of such, jurors don't really understand. At some point, we've got to draw the line. This is a problem. I've been doing this almost 38 years, and I see this almost every day. I mean, people are convicted in courts by juries on testimony of people that, you wouldn't believe the time of day from them. And it's imported into the courtroom. And I think, although I don't know, that this is one of the major reasons why perhaps the court granted this appeal, which ordinarily is not granted when there's facially sufficient evidence of the elements of the offense. And if you look at Sir Thomas Boyd, he's got four.
That's your time elapsed about 30 seconds ago, so if you'd like to wrap up quickly.
I will simply say this, and I appreciate that. I'll save, so I have no time left. I'll simply say Sir Thomas Boyd, he's less felonious, but not much better. For possession of cocaine charges, distribution of cocaine, possession of heroin with intent to distribute, petty larceny, petty theft, criminal mischief, selling drugs, admitted to using marijuana while on probation in two cities, incurring two probation violation convictions, and that he had a pending general district court matter. So, in conclusion, I would simply say the amalgam of these people, if you couldn't pick a better rogues gallery. And this young man is convicted, no direct evidence, yes, that he was shooting, but the essential evidence comes down to a group of people that I don't think any of us as professional lawyers or jurists could put any stock in. And I ask you to draw the line in this case on these jailhouse people. Thank you very much, Thomas.
Thank you, Ms. Bourne. You have your 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Of course, the defendant asks you to view each piece of evidence in a vacuum, and that's not what the standard of review requires this court to do. And I would also note that the defendant ignores the powerful circumstantial evidence in this case. There was a firearm which was recovered from a vehicle that had the defendant's palm print and fingerprint in, and some of his belongings, things that referred to his nickname, Hess Buck, and so forth. And a firearm was recovered from that vehicle, a firearm which was linked to the shooting, which three of the bullets from that firearm were found to have been the bullets fired into the victim. And so there's powerful ballistics evidence up over and beyond the testimony from the direct evidence that implicates the defendant in this case. With regard to the other evidence, we have Mr. Koval and Ms. Lachey both testified that the defendant was at a party with the other two co-defendants in this case, that they arrived together. We have Mr. Koval testifying that one of those co-defendants was the person who robbed him, and Ms. Lachey testifying that the other of those co-defendants was one of the people who shot the victim in this case. And the victim, we have to remember, was shot by three separate firearms. The ballistics definitively showed that. We also have Sir Thomas Boyd, who was an eyewitness and testified that he saw the defendant shoot a firearm, and then when he drove by, he saw the victim laying on the ground. He specifically identified the defendant as being the person involved. And that testimony was actually corroborated. It was not inherently incredible. It was corroborated by Mr. Riggs, who also saw two people running as described and discharging firearms. In addition, there were three jailhouse witnesses who identified two very incriminating statements by the defendant. And their testimony, in various parts was corroborated by the other testimony at trial. And, of course, we have Yates versus Commonwealth, which says that merely because a person is a convicted felon is not sufficient to find that that testimony is inherently incredible. These issues were issues that were to be resolved by the finder of fact. There was not sufficient evidence showing that the testimony in this case was inherently incredible. It was not shown to be false. It was not by other evidence at trial. So for those reasons, I would ask that you affirm.
Judges Russell and Malvo, any questions?
No.
None here.
Okay. Ms. Foreman, thank you very much for your argument, and you may move on to greener pastures whenever you'd like. We have two written.
I hope this one is as green as any.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I say that. Oh, you heard move on to greener pastures. Yes. Same from here. Same from the defense. And thank you all for allowing me a little bit of leeway on the time. I apologize. It's never easy, especially when you don't have the lights here, but in any event,
begin with, especially when you're in different locations.
Right. Although with modern technology, at least we can do it and hopefully do it adequately. The next one.